This is Spectrum.
Alternative myth, homeopathy, secret society, hypnosis, the paranormal, alternative energy, UFO abduction, the weird, the wild, and the wonderful.
With your hosts, Tom Theophanis and Scott Jordan.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to the Spectrum Radio Network on BBS Radio 2. I'm Scott Jordan, here with my co-host, Tom Theophanis, and remember, there's no such thing as too much information. Unless you have wisdom, in which case, you don't really need any more information. How you doing, Tom?
I'm good, Scott. How you doing?
I'm doing good. Well, this week, we've got Michael Cremo, so if you want to give us a quick intro on him.
Yeah, for sure. Michael is on the cutting edge of science and cultural issues. In the course of a few months' time, he might be found on a pilgrimage to sacred sites in India, appearing in a national television show in the United States or other countries, lecturing at a mainstream science conference, or speaking to an alternative science gathering. As he crosses disciplinary and cultural boundaries, he presents to his various audiences a compelling case for negotiating a new consensus on the nature of reality. Michael is a member of the History of Science and Society, the World Archaeological Congress, the Philosophy of Science Association, and the European Association of Archaeologists. After receiving a scholarship to study international affairs at George Washington University, Michael began to study the ancient histories of India, known as the Vedas. In this way, he has broadened his academic knowledge with spirituality from the Eastern traditions. So let's welcome Michael to the show. How you doing, Michael?
Great to be with you and all your listeners.
Thank you. Thank you for coming on the show, Michael.
My pleasure.
I think we should start out. You've been doing this work for quite a long time now. You've been around for a while doing this work. And I would be interested to know, what got you started or interested in human origins? And did it branch out from there into the forbidden archaeology area?
Yes. You have to know a little bit about the way I was brought up, because that had an influence on my path of knowledge. Okay. My father was a military intelligence officer. He was an intelligence officer in the United States Air Force. And that meant a couple things for me as I was growing up. First of all, it meant that our family was moving from place to place every 3 or 4 years within the United States and outside the United States. And that had a big influence on me. For example, when I was 5 or 6 years old, I was living in Hawaii. And in my school, I was exposed to people of Japanese culture, Hawaiian culture, Chinese culture, Philippine culture. I was exposed to a lot of different cultures and worldviews. So that had a big influence on me, because it made me understand that there's more than one way to look at things, like human origins, for example. The American way is one way, but there are other people, other cultures who have different ways of looking at these things. When I was 16 years old, I was going to high school in Germany. I was going to an American high school in Germany there. And you know, during my vacations, I would go all over Europe. So on one of my vacations when I was 16 years old, I went to Sweden. I went to Stockholm. And I was staying in a youth hostel there. And I met some young European kids who had gone to India overland and had come back. You could do that in those days. It would be a little more difficult in these current times that we're living in. But they told me just fascinating stories about their experiences in India, going to the Himalayan mountains. monks and meeting yogis and mystics and bathing in the Ganges River and all of this sort of thing. So I became fascinated with Indian spirituality, and I began reading books of Indian philosophy, different aspects of the Vedic literature. And as I grew older, I began to understand that I would have to come up with my own worldview, making use of whatever worldviews and cosmologies and philosophies I had come in contact with as I was growing up. So out of all the worldviews that I had come in contact with, the worldview of ancient India made, you know, the most sense to me. So I found a spiritual teacher, one of the gurus from India, His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, who is known in the West for bringing what's popularly called the Hare Krishna movement to the West. You know, George Harrison of the Beatles was his followers. Everybody has to make their own decisions about these things. I don't claim to have a monopoly on truth. I think truth can be found in lots of different places and lots of different traditions and lots of different ways. And, well, I'll just recognize truth wherever I find it. I don't claim that only I have, you know, truth. But I began to study more carefully the ancient Sanskrit writings of India, especially the Puranas, which are the historical writings of ancient India. And in them, I encountered histories of human populations going back millions and millions of years, right to the very beginnings of the history of life on Earth. And this was something quite different from what I learned from my teachers in high school and university. What I learned from my teachers in the official education system was the Darwinian theory of human evolution. I learned, well, human beings like us first appeared on Earth about 100,000 years ago, maybe 200,000, they would now say. And before that, I was told there were no human beings like us. There were simply more primitive, ape-like human ancestors. And before that, not even any ape men or apes and monkeys, just primitive little mammals. And so when I read these accounts of extreme human antiquity in the Puranas, the historical writings of ancient India, I was fascinated. And I began to see that these accounts of extreme human antiquity were found not just in the ancient Sanskrit writings of India. They were found in practically all the great wisdom traditions of the world, whether we're talking about the Bible or the Quran or the Buddhist teachings or Native American Indian teachings or Australian Aboriginal teachings or Egyptian, Greek, Roman teachings. Practically all these different wisdom traditions have held that humans have always existed on Earth, going back right to the very beginnings of life here. So I had to think, well, is that just mythology? Is that just fiction? Are those stories simply inventions by ancient sages? Or is there perhaps some factual basis for it? So that's what got me looking into the history of archaeology. So the first place I looked was in the current textbooks of archaeology. And there I saw only the discoveries that support the now dominant Darwinian evolutionary view of human origins, namely that humans like us have just been around for 100 or 200,000 years. Before that, there were no humans like us. That's all I found in the current textbooks. But then I decided, let me look beyond the textbooks. Let me look into the original scientific reports published by archaeologists, geologists, paleontologists, other scientists looking at the Earth. Let me look at their original reports published in the professional scientific literature from the time of Darwin all the way up to the present. And because of the way I was educated, I had a reading knowledge of most of the major European languages, like German, French, Italian, Russian. So I studied all of the reports by archaeologists, geologists, and paleontologists from the time of Darwin up to the present. And when I did that, I was surprised to find many reports of evidence showing that humans like us have been present on Earth for millions and millions of years. This evidence takes the form of human bones, human artifacts, and human footprints many millions of years old. When I started my research, I thought I would do a few weeks of research and maybe write a small article about my findings. But as I got into the research, the 8 weeks turned into 8 months, and the 8 months turned into 8 years, because one report led to another, which led to another. It was like a whole mystery investigation. So I collected all of those reports of archaeological evidence for extreme human antiquity and put them together in a book titled Forbidden Archaeology. Mm. And I had to ask myself a question. I'll tell you how the title Forbidden Archaeology came up. I had to ask myself a question. Well, why are these reports of archaeological evidence for extreme human antiquity there in the original scientific literature, but not in the textbooks? So
now that would be the question that I would ask. As you were saying that, in my head I'm thinking, okay, well, everything he's talking about must be being taught in universities all over the world, right?
Absolutely not. I just had to ask myself a big question. Why are these reports there in the original scientific literature, but they're not in the textbooks of archaeology that we see in high schools and universities today? And that led me to propose there's what I call a process of knowledge filtration operating in the world of science. And here I'm not talking necessarily about some satanic conspiracy to suppress truth. I'm talking about something that philosophers of science and historians of science have understood for a long time, namely that theoretical preconceptions can influence how scientists will evaluate evidence. For example, if there's a dominant scientific theory, then the commitment of scientists to that dominant theory acts as a filter through which they process evidence. Evidence that conforms to the dominant theory, in this case, the Darwinian theory of human evolution, evidence that conforms to the dominant theory will pass through that intellectual filter very easily, which means evidence of that sort will be found in the textbooks that students at high schools and universities will read. But evidence that radically contradicts the dominant theory will tend to be filtered out, which means you're not going to see it in the textbooks. You're not going to hear scientists talking about it on television programs on the History Channel and National Geographic Channel to see these objects on display in museums, although they may be there somewhere in the museum collection. So that's why I called my book Forbidden Archaeology. It's about archaeology, but it's not the type of archaeology you're going to read about in the textbooks. So that's how I got into this whole forbidden archaeology topic.
Well, we're sorry, but we got to take a quick break right now, and we'll see you guys on the other side.
If you suffer or know someone that suffers from back pain, knee pain, or any other chronic or sports-related pains, you need to visit LapingoProducts.com. Dealing with pain can affect every aspect of your life, which is why our products are designed to bring you real relief. Our products are not only easy to use, effective, and safe for the entire family, but our prices are competitive and offer a complete satisfaction guarantee. Visit LapingoProducts.com, real life solutions for pain-free living.
Hello, this is Scott Jordan, and I would personally like to thank all of our listeners for their emails of encouragement. It means a great deal to us. All of Spectrum shows are available in two formats, an MP3 stream you can listen to on our site, as well as a YouTube version. All of Spectrum shows are full length and free to listen to, and if I have my way, always will be. Tom and myself do all this work out of pocket, and freely give our time and effort to giving you, the listener, the best, most informative experience possible. I would also like to thank our listeners who have donated in the past to help with our expenses. Every donation goes directly to keeping the project alive. Thank you, enjoy, and keep listening.
AlternativeLifestyleProducts.com is your gateway to over 500 products ranging from herbs to pain relief products, health, and well-being. AlternativeLifestyleProducts.com is dedicated to educating and empowering you to make the best possible informed decisions about what products you can use to improve your health and well-being. Visit AlternativeLifestyleProducts.com and bring about change in your life.
So, Michael, you said that we have evidence that human origins go back millions of years. Where is that evidence, and how was it treated when it was brought out by the individuals that found it?
Well, that takes us into the whole history of archaeology. There are many cases like this. Some of them come from the earlier history of archaeology and some from the more recent history of archaeology. So I'll start out with a case from the earlier history of archaeology. During the middle of the 19th century, gold was discovered in California. So to get the gold, miners were digging tunnels into the sides of mountains like Table Mountain in the Sierra Nevada Mountains of California near the town of Sonora. And deep inside these tunnels in the solid rock, the miners found human bones and human artifacts, not just at one place, but at many different places in the gold mining region. These discoveries were collected by Dr. J.D. Whitney, who was the chief government geologist of California. He published a report about these discoveries in the year 1880. It was published by Harvard University. And what I find interesting about these discoveries of human bones and human artifacts is that they came from layers of solid rock that modern geologists tell us are about 50 million years old. They date back to the early part of the geological period called the Eocene. So these discoveries were very controversial. even though they were reported to the scientific world by a prominent geologist, and his report was published by Harvard University, one of the most prominent universities in the world. You know, we don't hear very much about these discoveries today because of the process of knowledge filtration. There was another scientist, a contemporary of Dr. Whitney's, named Dr. William Holmes. He was an anthropologist working at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. And he wrote, if Dr. Whitney had understood the theory of human evolution, he would not have published that report with those conclusions. In other words, if the facts did not support the dominant theory, the Darwinian theory of human evolution, those facts should not have been published, in the opinion of Dr. Holmes. They should simply have been forgotten. And basically, that's what happened. The discoveries reported by Dr. Whitney were forgotten. Now, a few years ago, I was a consultant for a documentary called The Mysterious Origins of Man that was shown on NBC, the largest television network at the time in the United States. The producer of this documentary, a man named Bill Cote, had read my book, Forbidden Archaeology, and he wanted to include some of the cases from the book in the documentary. So I told him he should go to the Museum of Anthropology at the University of California at Berkeley, because I knew that some of the discoveries from the California gold mines are still in the collection of that museum. So he went there, but the museum officials refused to allow him to see, what to speak of, film the artifacts. We were, however, able to find some photographs of the artifacts that Dr. Whitney had taken in the 1960s. We have some images to use in the documentary. But it was interesting what happened. When scientists who support the Darwinian theory of human evolution learned that NBC was going to show this documentary, they tried to stop NBC from showing it. They were not successful. Actually, the show was very popular, so NBC decided to show it again. And these scientists again tried to stop NBC from showing the program. They weren't successful. So then they went to the United States government, to the Federal Communications Commission, which is the agency of the government that regulates the television broadcasting industry. And they tried to get the FCC to investigate NBC, censure NBC, fine NBC millions of dollars so that they would never do anything like this again. Now, I'm happy to say the government didn't do any of that, but it was interesting that these attempts were made. And I've documented all this in a book that I put together called Forbidden Archaeology's Impact.
Right, so, which was the follow-up book that you wrote, because so many people were sending you questions about the original book, Forbidden Archaeology, that you put those questions in as well as your answers.
Yeah, that's right. Especially they were asking me, well, what's been the reaction to the kind of work that you've been doing in Forbidden Archaeology? So I put together this book, Forbidden Archaeology's Impact, just to answer those questions.
So it
and as far as these go ahead.
So it seems that these scientists were acting more like religious fanaticists, that they were no longer scientists. They were acting out of like a religious fanaticism on their theories.
Well, see, the problem is
fundamentalist archaeologists.
Yeah, I would call them fundamentalist Darwinists, really. I don't have any objection if somebody is a supporter of the Darwinian theory of evolution. I believe in intellectual freedom. I believe in academic freedom. I believe in freedom of thought. I believe that if someone thinks the Darwinian theory of evolution is the best explanation for human origins, if they really think human beings came from apes and monkeys, then fine. I don't have any problem with that. Where I do have a problem is when they try to maintain a monopoly in the education systems in different countries. In most countries, the supporters of the Darwinian theory of human evolution have a government-enforced monopoly in the education system so that only their ideas can be taught and all other ideas, all alternatives are excluded. Now, I do have a problem with that. Now, scientists like to talk a lot about Galileo. You know, Galileo was an astronomer who had some different ideas about the solar system, you know, a few hundred years ago in Italy. And at that time, it was the church with a capital C that had influence with government. So the church was able to use its influence with government to get the ideas of Galileo suppressed, and he was put under house arrest. And scientists like to talk a lot about that. But now, today, it's the supporters of the Darwinian theory of evolution who have influence with government. And they're doing the exact same thing that they accused the church of doing with Galileo. They're using their influence with government to exclude alternative ideas. There are scientists and researchers who do not support the Darwinian theory of evolution. Of course, the people who oppose, the scientists who oppose the Darwinian theory of evolution are today in the minority. It's a fact that most scientists today support the Darwinian theory of human evolution. That's a fact, but there are some who don't support it. And I think the ideas of those who don't support the Darwinian theory of evolution should be mentioned in the textbooks. They should be part of the curriculum. And I'm not saying equal treatment. I would say, okay, today 90 to 95% of the scientists support the Darwinian theory of evolution. So let them have 95% of the textbook pages and classroom time. But in the remaining 5% of the textbook pages and classroom time in biology or archaeology, the ideas of those who oppose the Darwinian theory of human evolution should be represented in a neutral, objective way. And then students should be free to make up their own minds about these very important questions. That's mm-hmm. what I think should happen. But now, this majority of scientists that has, they have a government-enforced monopoly in the education system in most countries, including the United States, and as far as I know, Canada as well. So I think that monopoly has to be ended. So, as I said, I don't mind if scientists or anyone else believes that the Darwinian theory of evolution is the best explanation, but I don't think they have the right to use government to impose their ideas in the education system on everybody else without giving any alternatives. That, I think, is a bad idea in a country or society that considers itself democratic. So that's my little soapbox.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I wouldn't be quite as diplomatic. I'd say they're basically acting as religious fanatics trying to block any information other than what facts fit their theory. And they should possibly dress in robes, carry around books, and burn people at stakes.
Well, it may come to that, I guess. They actually do that in the old days. The system was to burn people at the stake or whatever. Today, what they do is they burn a person's reputation at the stake. And I can give an example of that. We were talking about the California gold mine discoveries, which are from the earlier history of archaeology. And some people ask, well, maybe back in the 19th century it was like that, but certainly it's not like that today. But, you know, there's an interesting case of some discoveries that were made at a site in Mexico called Huayatlaco in the 1970s. Some American archaeologists working down there uncovered stone tools and weapons in layers of rock there in their excavations. And, of course, they wanted to know how old these objects were. So they brought a team of geologists to date the site. Among the geologists was Virginia Steen McIntyre. She and her colleagues used four scientific methods to date the site. They used the uranium series method. They used the zircon fission track method. They used the tetrahydration method. They used four scientific methods to date the site, and they came up with an age of over 250,000 years. When they gave the age to the archaeologist said, that's impossible. According to their theories, human beings capable of making the artifacts did not exist anywhere in the world 250,000 years ago. They had not evolved yet, according to the Darwinian theory of human evolution. So the archaeologists rejected the date given by their own hand-picked team of geologists. They refused to publish the age for the site. So Virginia Steen McIntyre and her colleagues were very surprised by this. So they decided to independently publish the age for the site in a scientific journal. And when they did that, they experienced an extreme negative backlash from their colleagues in the scientific world. Especially Virginia Steen McIntyre was a victim of this. She lost a teaching position that she held at a university in the United States, and her career as a geologist was effectively finished because she had dared publish something that contradicted the Darwinian theory of human evolution. So
she went up against the church and lost.
That's right. Now, she wasn't burned at the stake physically, but her reputation was burned at the stake. That's how it's done these days.
Yeah. We've talked many times on our show about what I call academic arrogance. And academic arrogance, you can see it in all kinds of different areas. And it's just, if the facts don't fit their theories, then they magically become not facts. They're no longer facts. They just disappear as facts. And yeah, it's amazing.
Isn't the same thing happening with the creationists? I mean, they brought out archaeological finds that they claim, that we haven't been here that long.
Well, I respect the right of anyone to present their ideas in the world of science and justify them with scientific evidence. There are, for example, young Earth biblical creationists who believe that the whole world and everything in it, including human beings, is less than 10,000 years old. Now, they base that on their reading of the Bible. Of course, in the world of science, you can't expect anyone to accept what you say simply on the basis of a scriptural statement. Even myself, many have called me a Vedic creationist. Okay, I accept that. And my work is based on my studies in the ancient Sanskrit writings, which speak of a very ancient human presence on Earth. Now, I wouldn't expect any scientist or archaeologist to accept what I say just on the basis of a statement from the Vedic literature. That isn't how science operates. There has to be evidence for what you say. And I believe there is archaeological evidence for extreme human antiquity, archaeological evidence showing that humans like us have existed for millions of years on Earth. So that's what I present in my work. I admit what my inspiration is, but I present evidence, archaeological evidence, to support what I say. So I believe that a young Earth Christian creationist has the right to make their case on the basis of the archaeological and geological evidence as they understand it. Now, I may agree or disagree with them. I would agree with a Christian creationist that we didn't evolve from apes, but I would disagree with them about the age of the Earth. But I believe they have a right to make their case using scientific evidence as they understand it, and people can consider what they say, what the supporters of the Darwinian evolution theory say, and make up their own minds about it. So as I said in the beginning, I believe in freedom of thought. And I believe they have, although I disagree with them, I disagree with young Earth Christian creationists about the age of the Earth. I disagree with them on that, but I believe they have a right to try to make their case using scientific evidence and logic. And I would say it's up to people in general to make up their minds about these things, whether they're going to agree with them or with the Darwinist or with me. That's up for each individual to decide. I don't think I would have a right to have government impose my ideas on everybody. I don't think the government has the right to impose the Darwinian theory of evolution on everybody. I don't think the government has the right to impose young Earth Christian creationism on everybody. I think these are decisions that each individual should make. Each individual scientist, each individual person has a right to make up their own minds about these things. We have a concept in the United States, at least, that there should be separation between church and state. And I think a lot of countries have the same idea, that there should be freedom of religion. People should be free to be atheists if they want to. They should be free to be a follower of any particular faith that they want. We, in most modern democracies, we support the idea of freedom of religion. We don't think that the state should impose a particular religion on everybody in the state. So I think there should also be separation of science and state. In the world of science, people have different ideas, and it shouldn't be the government's business to try to impose one particular scientific theory on everybody by giving the supporters of that theory a government-enforced monopoly in the education systems, the tax-supported education systems. That unfortunately is going on. So I think just as there should be separation between church and state, there should be separation between science and state. In the sense that the government should not get involved in imposing a particular scientific theory on everybody by giving it a monopoly in the public tax-supported education system.
Yeah, I think you should be able to believe whatever you wanted to believe. You know, I mean, I'm with George Carlin on this. My God is Joe Pesci.
Exactly.
Why not? Because Joe Pesci could get stuff done.
Well, you know, the thing is that, you know, there's always going to be controversy, no matter from what side you take it, you know, because the creationists are going to come up with, you know, their scenarios that, you know, that they show that, you know, these things are not very old. As a matter of fact, I remember not too long ago, I watched a little video on YouTube that shows some carvings in one of the temples in Cambodia of Stegosaurus, right? So, you know, the idea, I guess, would be that, you know, how do they know Stegosaurus were around, you know, at that particular time, unless, you know, they had dug something up, like bones and stuff. But it's the same scenario that seems to occur on both sides of the coin.
Yeah, there's always going to be differences of opinion. And I think in free democratic societies, government should stay out of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Most definitely.
And the academic temples should maybe open up a bit too.
Well, it is open to some extent. Where you get the real control is in the education system. For example, I'm a member of the World Archaeological Congress. I'm a member of the European Association of Archaeologists. I've presented my views at major international scientific conferences on archaeology and history of science. I've presented over 30 to 35 papers at major international conferences on archaeology and anthropology. So the world of science actually is open to some extent. There are some scientists who want to hear what I have to say. I've presented my views on archaeological evidence for extreme human antiquity, admitting my Vedic inspiration at major international scientific conferences. So there is a certain amount of openness within the scientific world for a diversity of opinion. But where it gets very difficult is when we're talking about the education system, what's presented in textbooks to students at high schools and universities. There isn't any diversity of opinion. Although the diversity is there within the scientific world, within the education system, the supporters of the Darwinian theory of human evolution have managed to get a government-enforced monopoly. Because somehow or other, they're the majority in the world of science today. So they've used that position of influence, that they're the majority, to get the minority views excluded from the public education system, which has the effect of delegitimizing alternative ideas in the minds of students, which are the next generation of scientists. Although there is a certain amount of openness in the scientific world generally, in the education system, there is not openness. There is a monopoly, a government-enforced monopoly for one group of scientists. And I think that's the real problem. That is the real problem that I think eventually we're going to have to confront.
Yeah. Do we know the age of the Vedas? When they were written?
Well, Veda is a Sanskrit word. It means knowledge. And according to the Vedic tradition itself, this knowledge has always existed from the beginning of creation until now. However, at certain points, it's an oral tradition being passed down verbally from one master to a student. And at other times, it's set down in writing. So the when it's set down in writing, it may be on perishable materials. And just like even today in our modern computer age, information exists in digital form, and it may be put onto a physical medium like a disc, a CD, or something like that. And then it may be copied. The disc may get old, get copied again, so that the oldest manifestation of digital knowledge in a physical form may only be a few years old, but really the knowledge has been around for a long time. So it's the same with Vedic knowledge. It's always existed, you could say, on the cloud of Vedic knowledge, if you could say that, the reservoir of Vedic knowledge and consciousness. It's always been there. And its manifestations in physical written form may be a few thousand years old, but that doesn't mean that that's how old the knowledge is. You know, the knowledge is far older. So those are the kinds of considerations that you get into when you're talking about the age of the Vedic knowledge.
Right.
Really, it's timeless. It's always been there. The physical manifestations of it may be, you know, say the oldest palm leaf manuscript in India may be a couple thousand years old, something like that.
Okay. So if we're talking about the earliest bones and stuff that have been found of humans going back this long, then where do humans come from? What do the Vedas say? Do the Vedas talk about some outside force creating the human biological unit, or does it? How is that covered?
Well, this is something that I get into in a book that I wrote called Human Devolution: A Vedic Alternative to Darwin's Theory. Yeah,
okay.
Because after people read my book, Forbidden Archaeology, in which I presented all the archaeological evidence for extreme human antiquity that contradicts the current theories of human origins, people did ask me this question. Well, where did we come from then? If we didn't evolve from apes within the past 100,000 or 200,000 years, where did we come from? What's your Vedic alternative to Darwin's theory? So to answer that question, I wrote this book called Human Devolution. And there I propose that, before we even ask the question, where did human beings come from? We should first of all ask the question, what is a human being? We should know what it is we're trying to explain, because how you define a human being is going to determine what kinds of explanations you can offer for human origins. Today, most scientists will say that a human being or any other living thing is just a machine made of molecules. We're just a very complicated arrangement of matter, the ordinary chemical elements like phosphorus, iron, calcium, all that. That's what we are. As a famous evolutionist, Richard Dawkins, said, we are survival machines, robot vehicles blindly programmed to preserve the selfish molecules known as genes. So that's what most scientists today will say. We are just very complex molecular machines. That's what we are. And as far as mind and consciousness are concerned, well, mind and consciousness are just byproducts of bioelectrical activity in the brain. If you organize the molecules in the brain in a sufficiently complex way, they will generate what we call mind and consciousness, but only temporarily and only in association with the brain. When the molecules in the brain become disorganized, as they do at the time of death, then there's no more mind, no more consciousness. So that's the view that most scientists today have. And that limits the kinds of explanations they can give for human origins. And of course, in addition to defining a human in a certain way as just being a complex molecular machine made of molecules, they also begin with the idea that you cannot have any higher intelligence involved in putting those molecules together. That means the only explanations they can offer for human origins are to say, okay, in the beginning, molecules were just floating around in the ocean. Somehow or other, some of them combined together to form some first self-reproducing single-celled organism. Somehow or other, some of those single-celled organisms started clumping together to form multicellular organisms in the ocean, you know, primitive plants, primitive fish, jellyfish, things like that. Then they proposed some of those aquatic plants and animals migrated to the land. You know, some of the land animals became amphibians, some became reptiles, some gradually developed into simple mammals, some of them developed into primitive apes and monkeys, some of them developed into ape men, some of them finally developed into human beings like us. Those are the only kinds of explanations that are allowed if you define human beings as nothing more than machines made of molecules. But what I propose is that a human being is something more than a combination of molecules. I believe that mind and consciousness exist on their own, independently from the brain, independently from molecules. So when I speak of mind and consciousness, I mean things that exist independently from the body. And there's some scientific evidence for this. For example, consciousness.
Okay.
There are medical studies of out-of-body experiences. There are times when, you know, a person should be totally unconscious. For example, during a heart attack, the heart stops beating, blood stops flowing to the brain, medical instruments show that the brain waves stop. At a moment like that, a person should be completely unconscious. Yet many people report separating from their bodies at times like that, and then they look down and they're able to see what the doctors and nurses are doing to revive them. So there's scientific evidence that consciousness can exist apart from the brain, apart from the body. And that opens up new explanations for human origins. What I propose is that originally we are beings of pure consciousness. We exist on a higher level or dimension of the cosmos, which I would call the level of pure consciousness. That's what we originally are. We are beings of pure consciousness who exist on this level of pure consciousness. And if a conscious self departs from that level, just like a spark might go away from the fire, we originally exist on that level of pure consciousness.
Right.
And if a conscious self departs from that level, like a spark might drift away from a fire, then what happens is consciousness becomes covered by matter. And those coverings are what we call bodies.
Right.
Now, including human bodies. Now, where do those bodies come from? Well,
that's the question.
Okay. Now, just like, say, normally as human beings, we're meant to live on land. If we want to live in an alien element like water, then we need a vehicle that will allow us to function under the water, like a submarine or diving suit, something like that. Now, naturally, if we stay on the land, we don't need any such vehicle. We just walk around on the land. But if we want to live in another element, we do need a vehicle that will allow us to function there. So where do those vehicles come from? Where does the submarine come from? Well, it comes from an engineer or group of engineers who understand that if human beings are going to exist under the water, they need a vehicle like a submarine. So these engineers design and build the vehicles. So in a similar way, if a being of pure consciousness enters into the realm of matter, then it requires a vehicle made of matter that will allow it to function in that alien element. So where do the vehicles come from? They come from a higher intelligence in the cosmos that understands that if a conscious self is going to function in the world of matter, it needs a suitable vehicle made of matter. So it designs and builds suitable vehicles for conscious selves to occupy in the world of matter. Now, the difference between these vehicles that we call bodies and vehicles like submarines is that these vehicles can reproduce themselves. Once the first ones are produced by that higher intelligence, they go on to reproduce themselves. So that is how these vehicles that we call bodies come into existence. And there's more than one type of vehicle because conscious selves display different desires, different levels of consciousness. So there's a whole range of vehicles that conscious selves can occupy. There are plant vehicles, there are animal vehicles, there are human vehicles, and a conscious self occupies a certain vehicle according to its level of consciousness. And one thing we notice about these vehicles that we call bodies is that they're temporary. For example, this human vehicle will last for no more than 100 years or so. Then what happens to the conscious self? Well, it gets another vehicle according to its level of consciousness. So there is a kind of evolution, but it's not the kind of evolution that Darwin talked about. Darwin talked about the idea that the bodies are evolving. Well, I don't accept that. I don't accept that a monkey body can evolve into a human body or any of that, or that a fish body can evolve gradually to become a human body. I don't accept that.
So macroevolution.
No macroevolution. What I accept is that the different kinds of bodies are always there. The human body is there, the fish body is there, the plant body is there, the insect body is there, the ape body is there, ape man body is there. What can happen is that the conscious self can gradually evolve through the different types of bodies until it gets to the human form. And the human body, the human vehicle, is a very important vehicle because in this vehicle, it's possible to go back to the level of pure consciousness, to get beyond all types of material limiting bodies, get back to that original state of pure consciousness from which we have all come originally. And that's really the main purpose of human life, not to fight over the control of material resources on this level of reality.
He who has the most toys wins. Yeah.
Right. The real purpose of human existence is to restore consciousness to its original pure state, where it's not limited by birth and death and different material coverings. That is the real purpose of human life, from which we've become distracted by too much materialism in human society today. We tend to think that the main purpose of human life is to produce and consume as many material things as possible in competition with other conscious selves that are trying to do the same thing. And that's why we have the kind of world that we see around us today, where we're destroying our environment, we're poisoning the earth, poisoning the air, poisoning the water. We're competing for the control of scarce material resources like oil, for example. We've divided our human society into different groups that are at war with each other. You know, there's conflict on all levels of human society, conflict among individuals, conflict among classes, conflict among nations, conflict among religions. It's, I think, the root of all of these problems lies in the mistaken conception of self that we're being indoctrinated in today through our education system. And basically, they're indoctrinating us in the Darwinian theory of evolution, which says we are machines made of molecules in competition with each other for survival. And I think if we had a different concept of the self, that we're all beings of pure consciousness, if we had that idea, then we would understand that our main purpose of life is not to produce more and more material things. We are meant to produce our material necessities in the most simple, natural, and efficient way possible, while putting most of our human energy into developing the resource of consciousness. And as conscious beings, we're all coming from the same source. There's no need to be dividing ourselves on the basis of superficial identities that have to do with the type of body that we have, a black body, a white body, a red body, a yellow body.
A body with a lot of money in the pocket, a body with no money in the pocket.
This passport or that passport or this religion or that religion. It's on the level of pure consciousness, we're all related to each other. We shouldn't be dividing ourselves up.
Right. It seems to me that with all of the ancient mythologies, and even mythology is a strange word to me too, because it seems that if it's in a book, it's history. If it's a cultural reflection on their history, it's a mythology.
Yeah. People tend to get absorbed in the externalities of religion when they should be focusing on what is real about spirituality. I mean, some people make a distinction between being spiritual and being religious. I think it's a valid distinction to make, because usually people who consider themselves to be religious, in a sense, tend to identify with one particular religious group in opposition to other religious groups, whereas those who consider themselves to be more spiritual tend to look at what unites people and living things rather than what divides them. So I'm in that latter group.
Right. What unites instead of what divides.
Rather than what divides. And there are, in different wisdom traditions, actual techniques of meditation and yoga and contemplation that actually can raise one's level of consciousness, where one gets practical experience of these things. You know, just like a geologist could tell us how to extract the element gold from its ore, where it's mixed with other less valuable elements. Now, once you've extracted the gold, you could form it into coins, and then you could stamp the coins with the symbols of different nations, Canada, America, South Africa, you know, Kruger Rands. But if it's actually gold, it doesn't matter what symbol that you've stamped on it. You know, gold is actually something valuable in its own right. No matter what symbol that you've stamped on it. So similarly, real spirituality in terms of understanding, I'm a being of pure consciousness. All others are beings of pure consciousness. We're all related to each other on that level of pure consciousness. If one, by some technique of meditation or yoga or contemplation, some spiritual discipline, if one is able to come to that level of awareness, then it doesn't matter what you call the process. You could call it Hinduism, you could call it Christianity, you could call it Buddhism or Judaism or whatever, Australian Aboriginalism or whatever. If you've come to that level of awareness, it really doesn't matter what you call, you know, the process. The main thing is that you've gotten to that level of awareness. And if you haven't, well, then you may be hung up on the label of the process and get into fights with others who label themselves in different ways. That's the unfortunate situation of today. So
it goes into my symbol stamped on my gold coin is better than your symbol stamped on your gold coin, yada, yada, yada. The ancient Vedas, do they talk about, I'm going to go in far left field here because that's what I do. Do they talk about UFOs? Because I know the term Vimanas is part of that culture. Now, they talk about UFOs back in the early writings?
Yes, they do. And this is something that I've talked about on a series called Ancient Aliens that's aired on the History Channel over the past year or so.
Yep, good show.
And what I've tried to do is give a Vedic perspective on ancient aliens, because according to the Vedic literature, there are 400,000 human-like species scattered throughout the entire universe. In other words, we're not alone in the universe. We're part of a whole cosmic hierarchy of beings. We have our place in it. And there's been communication between terrestrial humans and these other intelligences, human-like intelligences that are scattered throughout the universe. And there's been transportation, you know, between the different types of human beings, human-like beings scattered throughout the cosmos. And some of them make use of spacecraft called Vimanas. And the ancient Sanskrit writings, the Vedic literature, are full of accounts of these Vimanas or spacecraft. Now, many people today tend to have a very one-dimensional idea about aliens and UFOs. When they talk about aliens, they tend to think only of flesh and blood type creatures from other planets. And when they talk about UFOs, they tend to talk about nuts and bolts types of flying machines from other planets. I have a more expanded conception of what aliens and UFOs actually are. And, you know, this is, you know, based on my fundamental conception of what a human being is. You know, a human being is a combination of matter, mind, and consciousness. And I believe that the universe or the cosmos is divided into different levels or dimensions. Some levels are dominated by ordinary matter. Some levels are dominated by more subtle mental energies. Some levels are dominated by pure consciousness. So the different types of entities and different vehicles that come from different levels or dimensions of the cosmos are going to be different. Yes, there are going to be some Vimanas or spacecraft that are made of nuts and bolts, ordinary material elements. The Vedic literatures describe them. But then there are entities and vehicles that come from higher levels of the cosmos that are made of more subtle energies. You know, there are entities, beings from higher levels of the cosmos that are have bodies that are made of more subtle energies than our human bodies that we are experiencing on Earth today.
So if they had a craft, it would be made of a more subtle energy, in which
right.
case you can fade in and fade out of the of our level of our dimension.
That is correct. And so I have an expanded conception of what UFO and aliens really are. There are lots of different types.
Yeah, well, you would have had trouble with that conception about 20 years ago with a lot of the nuts and bolts ufologists would not have been willing to hear much of what you had to say. Jacques Vallée would have been an exception. But nowadays, I think it's the ufological community has expanded. And, you know, you can talk about interdimensional and nuts and bolts in the same sentence and have no difficulty.
Yeah, that's true. And I think that's one reason I've been invited to speak at a lot of UFO conferences. I've been kind of surprised, but I do get a lot of invitations to speak at them.
Yep.
And there are a lot of researchers, like you say, who have kind of gone beyond the nuts and bolts, flesh and blood conceptions of aliens and UFOs. And I think that's really a positive development. I mean, one of the researchers that kind of went in that direction was Dr. John Mack, who was head of the psychiatry department at Harvard University Medical School. He became interested in accounts of alien abductions, and he wanted to know, are these people psychotic or neurotic? So he did a psychiatric evaluation of a whole lot of these people, and he determined, no, they're not psychotic or neurotic. They're reporting real experiences, and they're displaying symptoms of what might be called post-traumatic stress, just like a soldier who's been in a big battle may display some signs of post-traumatic distress from a real experience that he's undergone. So he wrote a book about this, and his colleagues at Harvard University were outraged that a Harvard University professor was writing about UFOs and alien abductions as true. So they convened an academic court to get him removed from his position, get his tenure revoked. Professors at universities sometimes get tenure, and when they have tenure, it means they can't be removed from their position. So they were trying to get his tenure revoked. He successfully fought this, I'm happy to say. But in his book, Passport to the Cosmos, Dr. John Mack said, it appears ever more likely that we exist in a multidimensional cosmos. The universe is filled with different kinds of intelligences and spirits and things like that, which I thought was really great for a professional scientist at a major university to be saying these things, because the way that the scientific community tries to portray things, these are all things that are said on the fringes, outside the world of science. So to have somebody within the world of science saying these things was really a positive development. And I met Dr. John Mack when we were both speaking at a conference on crop circles that was held in Glastonbury, England. We met, and we were kind of agreeing to stay in touch with each other because he liked my research. I liked his. But then shortly after that, he died in a mysterious automobile accident in England. So it was a great loss. You know?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. It's a shame about that. Tom, do you have any questions?
Yes, I do. going back to the Vedas, do they speak of, you know, the catastrophes that may have occurred over eons and, you know, millions of years that may have contributed to, you know, loss of, you know, majority of life, if not all, at some point?
Yes, they do, Tom. The Vedic time concept is cyclical. And this is not something that's exclusive to Vedic cosmology. Lots of the ancient wisdom traditions have the idea of cyclical time. Many people are familiar with the Mayan calendar, which speaks of vast cycles of time. The Greeks and the Romans had the idea of vast repeating cycles of time. Now, in the Vedic cosmology, the basic unit of cyclical time is called the Kalpa, or the Day of Brahma, and it lasts for 4,320,000,000 years, and then it's followed by a Night of Brahma, which lasts for 4,320,000,000 years. And the Day of Brahma is also divided into cycles, sub-cycles, called Manvantars, each of which lasts about 300 million years. Now, according to the Vedic cosmological calendar, we're now in the seventh Manvantar of the current Day of Brahma. That means there have been six Manvantars before us. And according to the Vedic cosmology, after every Manvantar period, there is a devastation which wipes out most of the species on Earth. And after this, the Earth has to be repopulated. Now, that can happen because at higher levels of the cosmos, there are intelligent beings who have the knowledge to be able to do that, to recreate the species, to repopulate.
So like a reseeding.
Yeah, a reseeding of the Earth.
Seed
so
ball.
This, okay. So this happens about once every 300 million years or so, according to the Vedic cosmology. Now, according to the Vedic cosmology, as I said, the Kalpa, or the Day of Brahma, the current creation cycle, began about 2 billion years ago. And in that time, there have been six of these devastations that have taken place about every 300 million years since life began on Earth about 2 billion years ago. So it's interesting that according to modern paleontology, according to modern science, life began on Earth, you know, 2 or 3 billion years ago. Ballpark, it's about the same figure. And also, according to modern science, there have been, since the beginning of life on Earth, six major extinction events spaced at intervals of several hundred million years. So it's kind of interesting how the Vedic cosmology and modern science align on this important aspect that there have been repeated devastations, extinction events in the history of life on Earth. Now, the difference between modern science and the Vedic cosmology would be that in all the different time cycles, humans have been present. According to modern science, humans have only been present after the last extinction event, the one that wiped out the dinosaurs. But according to the Vedic cosmology, humans have been present in all the different time periods since 2 billion years ago, when life is manifest during the current creation cycle. So, yes, there have been periodic catastrophes, according to the Vedic literature, that have wiped out most life on Earth, after which the Earth has been repopulated by higher intelligences and higher dimensions of the cosmos. Yes.
Doesn't happen to say when the next cycle's going to be complete.
The next major devastation like that is going to take place, according to the Vedic literature, in about 180 million years. We're now in, according to the Vedic cosmological calendar, we're in the seventh Manvantara period of the current Kalpa, or day of Brahma. That Manvantara period began about 120 million years ago, according to the Vedic cosmological calendar. So the end of the Manvantara period will be in about 180 million years, and at that time there will be a major devastation.
Okay, so now, so we're good for 2012 then.
Yes, although there are, according to the Vedic cosmology, cycles within cycles. So the cycles within the Manvantara periods are called Yuga cycles.
We're in the Kali Yuga, yeah.
We're in the Kali Yuga, which is a down part of the cycle. So there are predictions in the Vedic literature that within the Kali Yuga there will be increasing social and environmental disturbances. So not a major world-ending catastrophe, but there will be increasing desertification, increasing extinctions of species, increasing levels of conflict in the Kali Yuga, and that will go on from now until another 400,000 years or so, after which there will be what's called the Satya Yuga, a golden age, where people are living in peace and harmony, and the environment is very conducive to spiritual pursuits, and society is not divided into classes and things like that. It's
all right.
Will gradually deteriorate. So for 2012, since it's the Kali Yuga, we could expect more environmental catastrophes. We've seen in recent years tsunamis and earthquakes and floods and disturbances in the weather. Sometimes people wonder about global warming. What the Vedic literature say is that as Kali Yuga goes on, there will be extremes of heat and cold. Sometimes people get confused, you know, because scientists say there's global warming, but they experience the coldest winters they've ever experienced. It seems contradictory, but not according to what the Vedas predict. The Vedas predict that as Kali Yuga progresses, there will be extremes of heat and cold, which is what we're experiencing. And we're also experiencing increasing environmental disturbances, not world-ending catastrophes. You know, there was a film out a couple of years ago called 2012 where they show the whole world being devastated.
Yeah, you know, I remember.
Massive flooding and things like that. That will happen eventually, but that's about 180 million years from now. But as the Kali Yuga goes on, I think we could experience in the year 2012 more of the types of things that we've been observing, like tsunamis, earthquakes, and flooding. That sort of thing could happen.
Oh, so if we hang in there for another 400,000 years, we're golden.
We're golden. We're in the golden age again.
Well, I have a kind of a question for this, though. If we managing to survive for 300 million years, technologically, do we get to a certain point that we can do, a lot more things than we're doing right now?
Well, yes, and in the past, we've actually, according to the Vedic literature, we've risen and fallen many times. The Greeks and the Romans had this idea as well. Plato and Aristotle said in their writings, human civilizations have risen and fallen many times. over the course of cyclical time. So millions of years ago, according to the Vedic literature, there were human populations that had vimanas, spacecraft, weapons resembling modern nuclear weapons, highly developed civilizations. So these things come and go. So over the course of the next millions of years, human civilizations will rise and fall many times. There are cycles within cycles within cycles, and things are going up and down all the time. So by the time that we come to the end of the Manvantara period, we will have been through many yuga cycles, which are a smaller time.
We would have been through many ups and then down and then evolution, de-evolution.
Yeah.
But even those situations would have to be catastrophic enough to make large changes to our abilities.
Yes, according to the Vedic cosmology, let's look at the yuga cycles. There's a cycle of four yugas. It starts with a Satya Yuga, a golden age. And in that age, according to the Vedic literature, people live for 100,000 years. The earth is in a paradisical state. People live very simply and naturally. Mostly they're engaged in yoga and meditation. There are no cities or villages. People are living naturally in beautiful forests, producing naturally all kinds of fruits and vegetables. They haven't divided themselves into classes and nations and things like that. That happens in the next yuga, which is called the Treta Yuga. Gradually, people become a little bit materialistic. Their lifespan goes down to 10,000 years, and they start dividing themselves into classes and begin developing different kinds of agriculture and industry. And then in the next yuga called the Dwapara Yuga, the lifespan goes down to 1,000 years, and people are becoming much more materialistic and less pious. And then in the Kali Yuga, the next age is called the Kali Yuga, and that's the age we're in now. It began about 5,000 years ago. In this age, people live for a maximum of 100 years, and they're extremely materialistic, and the environment becomes extremely degraded. And it's an age in which there's a lot of conflict and competition, and it's going to go on like that for the next 400,000 years. Now, the whole cycle of four yugas lasts for 4,320,000 years. So after the Kali Yuga, then there'll be another Satya Yuga, another golden age in which people live for 100,000 years. Conditions are very paradisical on Earth. It's not an age in which there's industry and things like that. That comes starting in the Treta Yuga, the Dwapara Yuga, and the Kali Yuga. So, and these cycles repeat again and again and again.
And these repeat universally. We're not talking just Earth-centered consciousness here, right?
Well, it is not necessarily just Earth, but Earth-level planets.
Ah, okay, gotcha. Okay. I gotcha. That
higher,
makes sense.
On the higher levels, they're not influenced by these things. It's the level that we're inhabiting now that is really influenced by this cycle of yugas. It's okay. What we might call terrestrial.
So other beings on other... in other dimensions or other areas of the universe could be beyond this whole cycle.
That's right.
Okay.
And they're there to repopulate or reseed the Earth, bring knowledge again when it's needed. Yes, on the higher levels, these things aren't, the yuga cycles aren't prominent. Now, if we're talking about the larger cycles of the Manvantara periods, when there's a Manvantara devastation, it goes quite far up into the dimensions. Only at the highest dimensions, they aren't touched by the Manvantara devastations that take place every 300 million years.
And that's just like an eraser of an Etch-a-Sketch, just completely.
Yeah.
Eraser.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, like that. And then there are even bigger cycles, like when the Kalpas end, then everything is just goes into a state of suspended animation during what's called the Night of Brahma. During the days of Brahma, life, including human life, is manifest at different levels of the cosmos. But during the nights of Brahma, everything is just put into a state of suspended animation. After the night of Brahma, then there's another day of Brahma or Kalpa, and then these creation cycles start with the Manvantara periods and the Yuga cycles, and this just goes on for trillions and trillions. It goes on endlessly, trillions and trillions of years, these different cycles. So it's a very vast conception of time.
I'll say.
And so, there are millions of universes as well. Here we're kind of getting into some parallels with modern cosmology, which a lot of cosmologists are now speculating. We're not the only universe. There are millions of universes, and they believe that at a certain point, the universes emerge from black holes and that they're sucked back in at a certain point of time. So there's a lot of parallels between modern cosmology and the Vedic cosmology in terms of the vast cycles of time, millions of universes expanding and contracting.
The in-breath and the out-breath.
The in- and out-breath of the Mahavishnu. Yeah, if we get to that level, according to the Vedic cosmology, there's a causal ocean, and there's a being called the Mahavishnu who's lying on the causal ocean. And then when he breathes out, millions of universes expand from the pores of his skin. And when he glances at them, he energizes them, and they begin to expand, these millions of universes. And then when he starts to breathe in, they all come back, the universes all come back into his body. They contract and re-enter his body. And his breath lasts about 311 trillion years. So when he's breathing out during those 311 trillion years, the universes are manifested. When he breathes in, they're unmanifested. So it's something that has some parallels with modern cosmology, the idea of expanding and contracting universes, and the idea that there are millions and millions of these universes. We're not the only universe. This is an idea that has become very common in modern cosmology, than to propose multiple universes.
Yes, that's true. That's true.
What was the accepted dates for the Vedas right now?
Well, modern scholars will just say they were composed of the oldest ones less than 1,500 years ago. That's what they'll say. According to the Vedas themselves, it's always existed in the universe, and it's manifested successively in different universes and the different time cycles. It's manifested again and again and again.
Right. I've heard numbers like 10,000, 15,000.
Some of the scholars may extend it to that level, but if you look at the Vedic literatures themselves, they're timeless.
Right,
and
right.
manifested again and again in different yuga cycles, in different manvantara periods, in different kalpas. It's but ultimately, Veda means knowledge, and knowledge is timeless. It exists beyond time, beyond space. Mm. When creations take place, you know, in the course of these different yuga cycles, manvantara periods, kalpas, when then Veda knowledge is injected into the different universes, the different planetary systems, and it's perpetually manifest. Like these days, you know, people are starting to talk about cloud computing, which means their files and programs are always existing, quote, in the cloud. But then they may have their different mobiles and laptops and computers that they access, this files and programs that are always there in the cloud. You know, they, but so that if their mobile device or laptop computer is destroyed, the files and the programs still exist in the cloud, as they
right,
say.
Right, right.
So it's a, sort of the same idea with the Vedic knowledge. It's always there, quote, in the cloud, and it's manifest, it's accessed.
So if it's knowledge, then all cultures, all the cultures on the planet have access to it. They just may write it differently.
Yeah, and it may be manifested differently in different times and places, but there's an underlying similarity. In my book, Human Devolution, I have a study on the cross-cultural, a cross-cultural study of cosmologies. I looked at about 30 different cosmologies of different people, different times, different places, Korean cosmology, Japanese cosmology, Chinese cosmology, Egyptian cosmology, Australian Aboriginal cosmology, Native American Indian cosmologies, Pacific Islanders cosmologies, Inca cosmology. And you see that if you look at them, they have a lot of common features. They all tend to have a multi-level cosmos inhabited by different types of beings at different levels. They all tend to have the idea that humans have always existed on Earth. They all tend to have the idea that a human being is made of matter, mind, and consciousness. They have these similarities. Now, they also have differences, but I think the reason the similarities are there, it's like people looking at a mountain from different directions. One person may be looking at the mountain from the north. Another person may be looking at the mountain from the south or from the east or from the west. So their descriptions are going to be different because they're looking at something from a different perspective. They're all talking about the mountain. So I think if we look at the different wisdom traditions in the world, the different cosmologies that are there, yeah, they're going to have some differences, but they're also going to have some underlying similarities. And the reason that the similarities are there is I think they're accessing the same ultimate reality just from different perspectives, different, yeah, they're filtering it through their different cultural viewpoints.
Right, right. And a lot of them, would you agree that a lot of them talk about, they use different terms for it, of course, but the star people or, you know, races off planet that have...
They do, as I say.
...come to Earth and basically, you know, reboot the biological units here.
Yes, that's a common feature of these cosmologies. They all tend to see the Earth as being on one level of the cosmos, but there are other inhabited levels of the cosmos. they all tend to see human beings as part of a larger universal family of beings, entities. And they may have different names for these entities. They may call them gods or goddesses or devas or jinn, or, you know, every culture will have its name for them.
Star people, yeah.
Yes, star people, but they all have the idea that we're part of a whole cosmic hierarchy of beings. There are different levels of the cosmos that are inhabited. There's communications between the different levels. There are movements of populations between the different levels. There's influences between the different levels. These are common features of all of these different cosmologies, which is one point I was trying to get across in the interviews that I gave for Ancient Aliens.
Right. And do you feel that that was edited well enough that you got that viewpoint across?
Well, I think I got it across a little bit. I would have, of course, everybody would like to, I mean, they interview you for quite some time, and then what they actually put on the shows is just a part of what you said.
Yeah, Reader's Digest version.
And of course, I would have liked to have more time on the series, but I was happy to participate in it, and I was happy to be able to get across whatever I was able to get across about the Vedic understanding of aliens and UFOs and cosmology and things like that. So I was happy with what I was able to get across. Of course,
that's
I would
good.
Have liked more time, but
who doesn't, right?
But that's why I'm glad we're having a lot of time to talk about these things on your show.
Radio, yeah. We have ancient mythologies about giants. What can you tell me about giants apart from the internet? There was a famous picture out there from a contest called Worth 1,000, and that's that famous picture of the giant in the pit and the guy standing beside it, and you know that was a contest. And a lot of people still think that that's a real thing, but a lot of the stuff on the internet's just not real. But there are researchers out there who do research the subject of giants seriously.
Yeah, absolutely. And I personally believe that giants existed in the past. And there are, if you go through the scientific literature, there are reports of discoveries of giant-sized human bones and things like that. The problem I've had at the moment, as I said, I do believe that giants existed in the past. The problem I've had is that I have not been able to personally verify any of the reports myself. And before I start publishing and speaking widely about these things, I would like to be able to verify at least one of these reports. And a few years ago, I thought I was going to be able to do that. There was a businessman in New Zealand who liked my books, and he invited me to come to New Zealand and give some lectures, which I agreed to do. So he met me at the Auckland Airport in New Zealand, and when we met, he told me, he said, tomorrow we're going to see something very interesting. He told me a friend of mine since childhood is working at the Museum of Natural History in Auckland, and he's going to show us the skeleton of a human being from some Pacific island over 10 feet tall. And I thought, okay, this is really amazing. Yeah, I've heard lots of reports like this, but now I'm going to be able to finally, you know, verify one. Now there are plenty of people living today who are 7 feet tall. You see them on basketball teams.
Eight feet tall, yeah.
Even 8 feet tall, but there's nobody 10 feet tall living
13,
today.
15, yeah.
So I thought, okay, finally I'm going to get to verify one of these cases. So we went to the museum the next morning, and the gentleman met us. And he began showing us through the museum, showing us the dinosaurs, showing us this, showing us that. Finally, we asked him, well, what about the large-sized human skeleton? And he said, well, I'm sorry, you know, we can't see it. So I had to wonder, well, what happened in 24 hours that he had told us, you know, he was going to show this skeleton. And then when the time came to do it, he said, well, I can't. All I can think of is that maybe that morning, you know, he had gone to, you know, he talked to some of his colleagues in the museum and told them what he was going to do. And they told him, don't do that. So I was kind of disappointed because I thought, well, finally I'm going to get some verification of one of these reports. Now, recently, you know, somebody sent me a copy of a report from the Scientific Journal telling about some discoveries that were made at a place called Castelnau in France, near Montpellier in France. And these discoveries were made in the 1880s, and they were reported in the scientific literature, accompanied by reports of large-sized human bones that came from this site. And the discoveries were made by a French anthropologist, and I've seen the pictures, and there are photographs of a large size fragment of a human humerus, which is the upper arm bone. If you look at your arm, the part above the elbow, going from the elbow to the shoulder, that's called the humerus. And then there was also a large size fragment of human femur. Femur is the thigh bone, you know, going from the hip down to the knee. Now, if an anthropologist, a physical anthropologist, has a thigh bone or a humerus, upper arm bone, he can measure that. And by measuring the length of the humerus or the thigh bone, he can, by using statistical analysis, tell how big, how tall the human being that had that femur or humerus was. And the analysis was that a human being with that size thigh bone or upper arm bone must have been over 11 feet tall.
There you go.
So that is really pretty good. Of course, the Bible speaks about these things, about Goliath being over 6 feet.
In a way, it makes sense. You've got a lot of the creatures. If you're talking about humans going back, you know, millions of years, you've got creatures back when there was more oxygen being huge. I mean, dragonflies that are 3 to 6 feet, you know, and everything's bigger because of the amount of oxygen. It would just make sense if there were human biological units back then that they would be larger.
Yeah.
Just like every other species is larger.
Right. And according to, say, the Vedas again, the Vedic literature, the Puranas, the historical writings of ancient India, before the Kali Yuga, in other words, before about 5,000 years ago, living things were bigger than they are today. And actually, that's, as you're mentioning, that's just part of standard science. You know, according to a paleontologist, before 5 or 10,000 years ago, most animals and plants were bigger than they are today. For example, there were the Irish deer. They had antlers 13 or 14 feet wide. They were much bigger than any deer existing today. You know, the wolves were bigger. The lions were bigger. The plants were bigger. I live in California, and in the Sierra Nevada mountains, they have the California redwood trees, the sequoias, they're called. And they're over 300 feet tall. They're actually the biggest living things on Earth, and they're over 5,000 years old, some of them. So I look at them as holdovers from a previous age when things were bigger than they are today. So if the plants and animals were bigger, then I would also expect the human beings were also bigger than they are today. The ancient Sanskrit writings speak of that. So, yeah.
It just makes sense. I mean, if you're going to put it in that sort of time frame when things were bigger back then of course, if humans are part of the species on Earth, then therefore they would be bigger. It just makes sense.
Well, in Greek mythology, there's plenty of giants there. And,
you know, that's true.
That's a good part of it. So.
Yep, that's true.
Oh, and a lot of different wisdom traditions, they have those kinds of ideas. And I think there is some factual basis for it. As I said, I would like to be able to confirm with my own eyes at least one of these cases. That's what I would like to do. And I hear lots of accounts as I travel around in different countries. When I was in Russia, some people told me that at a mosque in Samarkand, they have the bones of an Islamic saint over 20 feet tall. Now, maybe it'd be a little bit hard for me to get into a mosque in Samarkand to see that, but I would like to be able to verify at least.
You sure would like to.
cases.
Yeah.
Myself.
Take a digital camera. and a video camera.
Yeah, I mean, it's not that I'm the reason I'm saying that is because with some of the audiences that I deal with, they're intelligent people, they're open-minded, but they're a little skeptical, and they want to see some verification. So I would like to be able to verify at least one of these cases myself, and then I could speak about other ones that I know about from published sources and things like that. And of course, as you were mentioning in the beginning, you got to be careful about photographs circulating on the internet. Usually, those don't check out.
No, most of the time they don't. They end up being hoaxes or. They were competitions that, and it gets spread virally around the internet as a real thing, and they're just not.
Yeah,
you know, it's unfortunate, but so the way you've taken this, you're written your latest book, which is Forbidden Archaeologists. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And what's that focus on?
Well, that book is made of columns that I write for Atlantis Rising magazine. So what makes this book a little bit different, say, than my book Forbidden Archaeology is, well, first of all, it's shorter and each column is independent. You could just read it. It's like bite-sized introduction to my work for people who aren't familiar with it. Easy to read, bite-sized, interesting little essays about different aspects of my work. Whereas, say, my book, Forbidden Archaeology, you know, basically you've got to go through it chapter by chapter.
Yeah, you really got to focus and study.
And which some people like to do, but this latest book, The Forbidden Archaeologist, you could just pick out any one of the columns, the chapters there. There are about 50 of them. They're short. They're easy to read. You get a good introduction to some aspect of my work. And also in this latest book, The Forbidden Archaeologist, I get into not just the facts, but my experiences in doing the research, going around the world, presenting this type of evidence to different audiences. You know, I give some accounts of the opposition that I encounter from the fundamentalist Darwinist and things of that sort. So by going into this latest book, people will also get a little bit of personal insight to what it's like to do this kind of research and present this kind of information. So that's what this latest book is about. And then maybe from there, people might be inspired to go to some of the longer works like Forbidden Archaeology, Human Devolution, and Forbidden Archaeology's Impact, and really get deeply into the subject. So I think it's a good introduction this latest book, The Forbidden Archaeologist, is a really good, easy introduction to my work, you know, for people who might not be familiar with it. And then from there, they may want to go to the other books.
Yeah. Are you going to be giving any, do you have any upcoming lectures or we're coming to the end, so could you give out your website and any appearances that you'll be making over the next several months?
Yes. If people are interested about my upcoming lectures, they can go to my website, mcremo.com, mcremo.com, and they will learn about my upcoming lectures. In September, I'll be speaking in Sedona, Arizona at a conference called CPAC. That's the Conference on Precession and Ancient Knowledge. And I'll be talking about the Vedic time cycles as they relate to my forbidden archaeology work at that conference. It actually starts the 30th of September and goes through the first couple of days of October. Earlier in September, I'll be speaking in Marquette, Michigan at a conference there, an alternative history conference. And the details of that, the details of these events where I'll be speaking in September and early October can be found on my website, mcremo.com, mcremo.com.
And we'll have a link to that on the upcoming shows, as well as the next day when the show airs, we'll have it on the past shows archive. Just so everybody knows, all of the shows that we do are on our website, www.spectrumradionetwork.com. They're all full length and free to listen to. So every interview we've done there is there on the website for your enjoyment. And I really, really appreciate you coming out and talking to us. We had some technical difficulties, but we did manage to get around them.
Yeah. Well, I'm grateful for that. And it was really great, you know, being with you guys and all your listeners.
Thanks, well, Michael. Yeah, and we'll
see again.
And we'll catch you guys next week.
Fine. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.